Art Basel returns to Miami, bringing art, money, and hope. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. COVID canceled Basel's main event last year, costing the city and many of its artists and galleries millions. But it's back, with some limitations. We'll give you the rundown on where to go and what to see. Also, Florida Atlantic University is making a big move in the coming years to a new sports conference. This could be millions more dollars for athletics and a lot more television coverage for the school. Finally.
So liquids, they can drink, usually without trouble. But if it's a solid food, they need to start digesting it before they bring it into their body.
A closer look at what flies are doing when they land on your lunch. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Art Basel is back in Miami. After losing a year to COVID, many of the events are returning, but with some limits. We've got a rundown of what to expect during Miami Art Week 2021. Also, if you're an artist that's happy to see Art Basel return, share with us how important this annual Art Fest is to your bottom line. You can text us now, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Or find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We're joined now by Brett Sokol. He's a contributing writer on the arts for the New York Times and the co-founder of the nonprofit publishing house Letter 16 Press. Brett, how are you? Great to have you back.
Always good to be here. The art circus is definitely back in town.
And are you at the show right now? Where are you at?
I am at the Knot Affair, which sort of, best way to describe it is all the art handlers. There's a small army of them who are swarming over the Ice Palace, which is in Overtown, just north of downtown. So the Knot Affair, it's probably one of the biggest, certainly most important satellite fairs that sort of revolve around the mothership of Art Basel at the Convention Center on Miami Beach. And my nonprofit publishing house, Letter 16 Press, is actually exhibiting over at the Knot Affair. So I'm essentially doing both duties. I'm both covering some elements of the fair, and then over at NADA, we're setting up to showcase the photography books that we're doing. So I'm sort of surrounded by a bubble wrap factory at the moment.
All right. Already back into the groove. That's good to hear. I mean, you know, because Art Basel was canceled last year, has it been difficult, a difficult comeback for the art scene here in Miami?
You know, artists never stop making work. So I think there were certainly financial difficulties for a lot of artists and for a brief period, some of the dealers as well. But one of the interesting things that happened is that even as gallery sales were becoming very sluggish and slowing down around the rest of the country, Miami really started to pick up in no small part because of the influx of really wealthy individuals that essentially fled a lot of cities, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, and a lot of them ended up here in Miami, either moving into houses that were vacation houses or buying a whole new place here. And blank walls mean time to buy art. And so a lot of those folks started hitting the Miami galleries. And so that's one of the interesting things that I found. For example, I spoke with the director over at the Fred Schnitzer Gallery. And instead of hearing sort of a tale of COVID woe, you know, the last, you know, 6 months or so, they've been as busy as at any point over the past 5 or 6 years. And most of that is due to new clients, you know, new collectors, people who might have seen their work at an art fair that the Fred Schnitzer Gallery participated in, but now they're in Miami and they sort of walk in through the front door and they become essentially part of their local collecting base. And you're seeing a lot of that, you know, at the different galleries around Miami. And of course, all the out-of-towners on top of that are here this week for Art Basel. It really is just a frenzy of activity already taking place. Like I said, I'm outside the Ice Palace right now. It's like Grand Central Station. Semi trailer trucks, more people with, you know, hammers and drills than you can imagine running around.
And you, it was interesting. You pointed out in your last piece in the New York Times how, you know, once the travel restrictions, international travel restrictions loosened up, you know, people just, they started calling in like, okay, we're ready. They were ready for this.
Absolutely. I mean, I spoke with Mark Spiegler, who's the global director of all three Art Basel fairs, the one here in Miami, the flagship in Switzerland, and also the newest one in Hong Kong. And, you know, going into September, things still looked pretty gloomy, mainly because there was a travel ban in place, a COVID travel ban, in that unless you were, you know, a citizen, pretty much everybody else from Asia and Europe was not allowed to enter the United States. And you can't have an international art fair without international people there to buy the artwork. Otherwise, it's just a much smaller ordeal. And on September 20th, when the Biden administration announced that they were going to be lifting that travel ban in November, it was like a starting gun went off. Mark Spiegler told me that his phone just blew up and that there were more than 30 galleries that just a few weeks prior had said, look, we're not going to be able to participate in Art Basel in Miami because, frankly, we don't even know if we can get into the country, you know, so it's just not going to happen. And within that 1 week, more than 30 galleries called back to essentially uncancel, you know, said, you know, we told you we weren't going to be there. Well, everything's different now. We definitely want to be there. And the same thing is happening with hotels, you name it. I mean, everybody's converging on Miami.
You know, you had reported on how, you know, last year there were still some events. There were still some parties. But I'm wondering, what does Miami lose, you know, when you don't have a full Art Basel? And it's not that I need a specific number. I'm just wondering, like, you know, how much do you think we lose, and how does it affect the city and artists here?
Well, you know, it's hard to quantify actual dollars and cents. I mean, if we, you know, if you were to put a serious figure on it, you know, look, if you talk to the Chamber of Commerce, they'll tell you it's $100 million. That's ridiculous. It's probably closer to somewhere between 12 and 17 million in terms of an actual economic impact. But the bigger effect on the art scene here is that Art Basel really helped spark a homegrown art market. And that meant that artists could actually make a living as artists staying in Miami. And people may take that for granted now, but that's a fairly recent phenomenon. If you talk to older artists, really, you know, there were always great artists doing work here in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, but what they didn't have was a way to make a living as an artist. Most of them either had teaching jobs or, you know, some other kind of gig, and art was something they essentially did on the side. And Art Basel really focused the world's attention on both the Miami art scene, and it really lit a fire under the butts of a number of Miami collectors who really weren't collecting a lot of emerging Miami artists. And all of that came together and really helped catalyze a market so that artists can make a living as artists. They don't have to move to New York. They don't have to move to LA. They can stay in New York. In fact, you have a number of artists who are moving from other places to Miami because it's easier for them to get noticed here in Miami than someplace else. And again, that's a pretty new phenomenon. And whatever the downsides of the Basel effect may be, you know, don't undercount what that means to artists who are here in Miami and trying to make it as artists.
Yeah. And there's still a question as to whether the other two Art Basel events are going to happen, the one in Switzerland, the one in Hong Kong, because of their restrictions. But that's for another time. We know we have this one. You know, going back though to last year, because as you had pointed out, there were still some collectors who decided, yeah, you know what, we're going to have parties anyway. You know, and I wondered, you know, how did we see any super spreader events? Were there any problems or issues? It seemed that was a bad time to do it, but some people still went ahead and did it.
Look, this is Miami, and I love this city, but there's no shortage of idiots running around this town as well, to be blunt. So, and as, you know, reporters at the Herald and also at WLRN have shown, it's really hard to trust the information coming out of the Florida Department of Health. So it's hard to know if there were super spreader events. Certainly, I think most sensible people were not partying in Miami during our Basel, certainly not without masks on. So I can't tell you what the effects were. Certainly I wasn't out and about, but what can I tell you? It's
yeah.
Miami.
And look, not to be the party pooper here, but, you know, got a report. We're finding out information now about this new Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Is that being discussed right now? Is anyone working, you know, this art week? Are they worried about that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even before that was announced, the main Art Basel Fair made it very, very clear that they were going to be taking serious safety protocols, putting them in place. So, for example, proof of vaccination or a recent test result is required to enter. And they also have a mask mandate in place. It's a requirement. It's not optional. It's not recommended. And they're going to enforce it. You know, I put that question to the director, the global director of Art Basel, Mark Spiegler. I said, look, you know, this is Miami, and you still have more people walking around without masks here in indoor spaces than, you know, a lot of the cities where collectors are coming in from, like New York or L.A. and San Francisco. And you've got to be frank, you know, billionaire art collectors who really aren't used to being told what they can and cannot wear. Are you going to tell these people that they're going to have to leave the fair? That are you going to physically have them ejected by security if they refuse to put a mask on, or if they, you know, somehow have a physical problem pulling it up over their nose, like some people do?
What did he say?
He said, absolutely, they will be physically ejected by security if they refuse to comply with a mask mandate. That's what a mandate means. It's required. And the main satellite fair is like NADA, and the Untitled Art Fair, which is over on Miami Beach as well, they have the same protocols in place. You need to show proof of vaccination or a recent negative test result to enter, and you have to wear a mask indoors at all times. I'm sure there are going to be plenty of other parties and pop-up events of all kinds where people don't take these things seriously or they pay lip service to them. But for the serious art events, they're being taken seriously because they have to, because to be frank, there's a lot of money at stake. And if the fairs get canceled or they can't have it again next year, you're talking about losses of millions of dollars, especially for Art Basel. You mentioned, I mean, Art Basel Hong Kong, it is doubtful that is going to happen now.
Right.
And, you know, given the new variant, who knows what's going to happen when Art Basel in Switzerland next June is supposed to take place, which means it's all the more important for Art Basel that their Miami fair goes off smoothly and without a hitch, and that people feel comfortable going there and shopping.
I almost want to pay just to see them throw out a billionaire. Again, talking just for that. I'm talking with Brett Sokol, contributing writer on the arts for the New York Times and co-founder of the nonprofit publishing house Letter 16 Press, talking about Art Miami Art Week and Art Basel. It is back. It was canceled last year because of the pandemic. And again, I want to hear from you if you're an artist, if you're, you know, maybe you're in Wynwood or Little Haiti or anywhere, you know, what it means to have even limited amount of events. You know, it's not as big as it was before, but still, just to have it back, what does that mean for you? Find us on social media, WLR and Sunda. I'd love to hear from you. You know, you talked about there are going to be restrictions. So expect, again, to at least in the main events, you got to have a mask, you got to show proof of vaccination or test. But what is back exactly? I mean, we're not going to have everything pre-pandemic, but what is back? What can people expect? And what would you recommend people do?
Well, first of all, go see the art. You know, there's a dizzying number of parties that are being launched. When we talk about, I think that was the question that a lot of people had, you know, would this return see a full-throated return? And I would say absolutely, almost to the point where it's a little unnerving how many people have suddenly decided to throw parties, some of which have very, very little to do with art. For example, I had one person contact me last week. Cheetos is having an Art Basel party with art made from the orange Cheetos dust. And of course, it's on a yacht because it's Miami. And that's funny and it's kind of ridiculous, but it does tend to take attention away from some of the really wonderful art that is being made and being shown. And a lot of it's being made by Miami's own artists. I'm thinking, you mentioned how have things changed over the past few years. A great example of that is the artist Jared McGriff, who moved here a number of years back from the West Coast, decided he wanted to essentially reinvent his life as a painter And his career has really took off in an almost meteoric way. He had his first big solo show at Spinello Projects last year during the Basel That Wasn't, but it still garnered a lot of attention. A lot of key collectors bought the work, a lot of museums bought the work, and now he has, just a year later, a solo retrospective. Maybe that's not the right word because he hasn't been painting that long, but it's a solo show of his absolutely gorgeous paintings up at the NSU Museum of Art in Fort Lauderdale. And they're truly, truly wonderful paintings. They're moving. They mine the Black experience at the same time as just being just viscerally exciting to take in.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about this. You pointed it out in your last piece, which, by the way, we're sharing a link to your last piece in the New York Times on our social media. You know, you talked about NFTs, non-fungible tokens. All right, hold on a second. Yeah. First of all, because there's a lot to talk about here, seriously, is the art world taking these things seriously?
So here's the really important thing to understand about NFTs. First of all, if you're scratching your head over them,
I am.
You are not alone. There's something slightly ridiculous about the whole idea of essentially making a digital image unique. And there's an awful lot of money trading hands around NFTs. And there's an awful lot of talk around NFTs in the art world. But here's the important thing to keep in mind. The people that are spending all of this money on NFTs are not buying other contemporary artwork. For example, the people buying NFTs are not buying paintings by Basquiat or Rothko or other major talents. And vice versa. The people who are spending millions of dollars on contemporary art, the names that you've come to recognize, an Alex Calder sculpture, or even the Miami painters, they are not spending that kind of money on NFTs. These are two separate worlds. They're adjacent to one another. They see each other. They track one another, but there's still something of a moat between them right now. That could change, but they're still two separate worlds. So it's important to keep that in mind, that if you, as someone just being introduced to NFTs, seem a little skeptical about, first of all, the appeal of it, and why would I want to pay all this money for something that I can just look at on my screen? Well, there's a huge chunk of the art world that agrees with you, even if they don't necessarily want to come out and be that blunt about it.
But Miami, you said Miami is going to be full of NFT shows.
Yes, because there's a lot of money at stake. There's a lot of companies that are trying to cash in on it. I mean, it's essentially a financial play. I mean, that's what this craze around NFTs really is right now. Is it's less about aesthetics per se than finances. So there's a lot of people that see this as essentially a get rich quick scheme. Some people have already made a lot of money on it. And look, again, this is sort of the tough love approach to Miami.
Brett,
this is a city of hustlers.
Tell me, Brett,
it makes sense.
What is an NFT focused gallery visit like, for heaven's sakes?
I personally find it a little ridiculous, the idea that you would have to come to a physical space to look at something that exists on a small screen. I think that speaks to the fact that there's really no substitute for the physical experience. This came up a lot, you know, during the past year and a half of the pandemic, was that people said, oh, everything's moving online now. You know, we're just going to be looking at art on our screens. The museum going experience is going to change. And one of the things that we saw was that as soon as it became possible to go back into museums and galleries with safety protocols in place, people really wanted to do that. People want to see a painting in person, a real oil on canvas up on the wall. There's no substitute for standing in front of a powerful work of art. Your phone just doesn't come anywhere near that.
Can I just tell you, I'm really angry. I went to art school, Brett. I went to art school to learn how to paint. And now you're making millions on these little digital images. What in the world? You know what? We're hearing more about this metaverse with Facebook and Web 3.0, this new internet period. I don't understand. Again, this goes back to NFTs as well. Are you hearing from artists here locally about this? And are they interested in it? Not just the collectors. I'm talking about the artists.
There's still, you know, there's again, when I talked about that moat between the contemporary art world and the NFT world. And that still exists, I think, within, to a certain extent, the Miami art scene. Most of the respected Miami artists, certainly the really talented ones, for the most part, are not participating in NFTs yet. One of the exceptions is someone that I spoke to for the New York Times, was Carlos Betancourt, who did take the plunge, and he was tapped to create some NFTs to benefit the Reef Line, which is an underwater marine park, by a new NFT platform called Aorist. And it was very telling. I asked him what made him take the plunge, sort of what made him finally go, okay, you know, he's someone who's been making art here in Miami since the 80s in all different mediums, photography, painting. He's done, you know, video, sculptures, installations. What made him finally go and do an NFT? And he said part of it was that there was a curator involved at this platform that had been a longtime supporter of his work. But also, this is very telling, that platform agreed to also do an accompanying physical version of the NFT, because he really wanted to have a physical component to this digital piece of art. So the NFT is of these two icebergs, and they've actually created two huge real fake iceberg, real fake,
sure, right.
Real fake icebergs, 20 feet high by 30 feet wide, which will be floating in the pool of the Faena Hotel. And certainly if you want to dramatize climate change and sea level rise, I think putting an iceberg in the heart of Miami Beach certainly does that.
And you know, just to mention too, we talked with, you know, Carlos Betancourt recently about his new piece that's at the Intercontinental Hotel, that replaced the dancing lady there. And so, you know, we talked to him about
the ever tasteful dancing lady.
It was fascinating. He really is. Briefly, give me two or three artists you're looking forward to for this week that you want to see.
A personal favorite of mine is the painter Hernan Bas, who's been he's born and raised here in Miami, and you can see a show of his brand new work over at the Fred Snitzer Gallery, and you can see a show of his very early work over at the Rubel Museum. I mentioned Jared McGriff, who's got paintings up at the NSU Museum of Art in Fort Lauderdale. You can see Yanira Kalata's work over at the Emerson Dorsch Gallery. She does a really interesting mix of painting and sculpture. She's taken over the whole gallery in a sense that it looks like you've sort of wandered into this house that's kind of falling apart. Gary Monroe is a photographer who's been doing work here in Miami since the 70s. And he's got several different bodies of work. All of them are amazing. The one that's up now at the FIU Miami Beach Urban Studios are his photographs of the refuseniks from 1980. And these were Soviet Jews who were finally allowed to leave the Soviet Union after massive repression. And they were resettled, many of them, in the hotels of South Beach on the way to getting more permanent housing. And it's a period when South Beach was very, very different from the way that we know it today.
If I could, and you talk about South Beach, and I wanted to ask you this before we finish up here. You know all of that's going on in South Beach, the move to try to change the atmosphere on the entertainment district. And just briefly, because of time, what do you think about that move? Because the mayor has said he wants to get rid of the spring break crowd. He wants more of an Art Basel crowd.
Yes, they've made it very clear that they feel that the future of South Beach lies in arts and culture and not in sort of a spring break bar street festival kind of situation.
You think that'll work?
You know, we'll see. I mean, clearly the current situation is not really working for anybody. I don't know anybody's really happy with the way things currently exist. So I think there's certainly a lot of support for what the mayor is doing. It's easy to get lost in some of the spin that's going on. There were a number of bars that spent an awful lot of money during the last referendum that was held about rolling back. Right. And it was really just a handful of bars spending over a million dollars, essentially to try to smear the mayor in a way that was a little depressing to see some of the local media fall for that.
Yeah. Let's see how this all turns out. You know what? In 30 seconds, tell me, because Art Basel Miami has always given us some interesting moments. A few years ago, sadly, somebody got stabbed and yet people thought it was art. And then, of course, there was the banana taped on the wall. What do you think? What's going to be the strange thing that sets this one apart? What are you expecting?
Actually, that's what makes Art Basel so interesting, is I can tell you what I'm going in to see now and what I think will capture people's attention. But, you know, the last full-fledged fair, 2019, if I had said to you, oh, $120,000 banana is going to capture the popular imagination, you would have thought I was insane. And yet that's what did it. They had to have security come to stop the crowds from overwhelming the banana taped to the wall that was being sold, that sold for $120,000. So again, I'm looking forward to seeing what fresh round of insanity takes off this year. That's part of the fun.
Absolutely. You know what? I think it's going to be it's going to be with the masks that we wear. Somebody's going to do something, and that's going to be the thing. Brett Sokol, contributing writer on the arts for the New York Times, co-founder of the nonprofit publishing house Letter 16 Press. We got a link to his latest piece about Art Basel on our social media, WLR and Sundial. Brett, always so much fun. Have a great time this week.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Still to come, FAU is changing to another sports conference, and that could mean millions more for the school. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Atlantic University recently announced it's moving sports conferences. That's a big deal. Currently, FAU is in the USA Conference, but in a couple of years, it's going to be moving over to the American Athletic Conference, the AAC. And that conference has teams like Cincinnati. Cincinnati could win the national title this year. We spoke with Brian White, director of athletics at FAU, about the move and what it means for the football team, the athletic department, and the university. For those who don't know, colleges are part of conferences, and that means that you are linked to a group of other schools that you compete with. And right now, FAU is in Conference USA, but you're going to be moving to the American Athletic Conference. What is that going to mean for FAU?
It's a huge opportunity for us to improve our brand, to grow our brand, both athletically and academically. You know, for those that don't track college athletics too closely, you know, the reason we feel like we exist is to serve as a front porch for the university and to provide great exposure through athletic competition and success and on the athletic fields, but also national television exposure and exposure amidst high brands that we compete against. So we're very excited about the increased television exposure in the league, in the American, as opposed to our current conference within Conference USA. Conference USA has been a great partner for us for 9 years now, but we're very excited about the opportunity, and it's a chance for us to affiliate ourselves with some really great, credible brands within college athletics.
And, you know, I mean, obviously the biggest one is being football. How does it help all the other sports teams?
There are just a exponentially increased number of nationally televised events, and also through the ESPN and ESPN2 and ESPNU and ABC to the multimedia package within the American Athletic Conference. So that increased exposure will benefit every one of our programs. There's also an increased level of compensation via the media package from the conference. So the conference distribution will be much higher, and that goes to support all of our 19 sports and 450 student athletes. So it's a great thing for everybody.
You know, it's something interesting you said, you know, it's like being that front porch. And I always wondered, like, the role that sports play for a university. Is it the biggest way to really build the brand of the university? Or how else does sports, you know, help to expand a university and help a university grow?
You know, I think it is. And I think a lot of presidents have proven that they believe that college athletics is a great way to grow the brand of the university. And that's why we've seen such investment in college athletics. You know, there's an old study, and there's been many academic studies, but I think the first one I'm aware of was the study of the Flutie effect, when Doug Flutie completed his famous Hail Mary touchdown pass to win a football game. And they studied the applications that led to an increased enrollment and a better quality quality student admitted into the university. And we've seen that through, you know, the run that Butler basketball made, the run that Alabama football has made. There's been academic studies amidst all of these successful runs. And it's just, I think it's been proven time and time again that the media exposure provided from athletics benefits the university in so many ways. There's even been specific studies in the college football playoff that show the winner of a game or the teams that compete in a specific game. They'll study those, the applications from that night versus the rest of the year. And of course, they're skyrocketing that night because everybody a good portion of the country is watching a game and thinking about, hey, should I send my son or daughter to that school? Or if you're a high school student, you're thinking about, should I go to that school? So ideally, all of these universities are being showcased. And as athletic departments, we're thinking about how can we have more success and grow our brand so we have more and more exposure on a larger scale so that more people know about our university. And for us, that's a great university, 1.8 miles to the beach. And we love to sell our paradise, but we also have many, many great academic programs, and we're ever improving university. And that's kind of why this opportunity is so exciting.
By the way, when you mentioned the Doug Flutie thing, you did kind of remind people of a bad memory. That was the famous Hail Mary pass when he was at Boston College, and they beat the University of Miami. So, of course, you know, some people will thank you for that reminder. But, you know, it's something interesting is, you know, you talk about, because you just mentioned how close Florida Atlantic University is to the beach and the where you're located, you know, in South Florida. And I always wondered, when you're recruiting athletes, you know, what is the selling point? What's the most important part of it? And you think about, you're in South Florida, you've got FIU, you've got UM, you've got FGCU on the other side over in Fort Myers. You've got a lot of schools to compete with. So what is the big selling point for FAU?
You know, I guess it depends in some ways on if the athlete is local or out of state. I would say both have different recruiting pitches. One, we feel like we have the best recruiting area in the world, really, with where our university is located in South Florida. But that goes the same for the other three schools you mentioned. But we do really feel like our campus, our university experience is unique. The great thing about local athletes is an unofficial visit. They can come with their families a lot more often and a lot easier. And if we're able to have a recruitable athlete on campus, we're able to have them visit with all the great people we have in place, both on the academic and athletic side of the house, give that tour, see our beautiful facilities. And then, you know, we are very proud of where we're located. I think that we have probably a unique sell to anywhere in the country. And the same goes for those, you know, we recruit a lot of international, and the beauty of sometimes an international recruit is they don't know the difference between Florida Atlantic and Florida State, but they know we're in paradise and they look at us and see Boca Raton. So that Power Five brand name doesn't hurt over there. But, you know, if we're recruiting a student athlete from Canada, they love the location of Boca Raton. So it helps us all over the world. Our home turf of Broward, Dayton, and Palm Beach County is always going to be our key area of recruiting.
We're talking with Athletic Director Brian White of Florida Atlantic University. The university announced that it's going to be moving from Conference USA to the American Athletic Conference. And that means more opportunity for more television time for its sports teams and, of course, more money for the athletic department. You can learn more about this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so I want to talk a little bit of football with you. And I recall many years ago, we'll not mention so we don't share our age, but when I was a young reporter, I remember when your former first football coach, Howard Schnellenberger, and anybody who remembers him, he coached at UM, he coached with the Miami Dolphins, he helped launch the FAU program. And I recall him saying, in that deep southern drawl, you know, he promised FAU would win a national title. Now, he made the same promise at UM and did deliver. But realistically, I mean, FAU is a big school. It's grown a lot. But when you talk about football, you know, the big money maker in college, do you think realistically it could ever compete at that level with Alabama and Georgia and Ohio State and Michigan State and Notre Dame?
I do. And since we mentioned Howard Schnellenberger, I feel like every time his name comes up, obligatory, I have to mention that should be Hall of Famer Howard Schnellenberger. But no, Coach Schnellenberger had a wonderful vision for this place, and none of us would be here without that. And I don't think anyone at this university would be willing to back off that promise. Our president, Dr. Kelly, has a tagline for the University of Unbridled Ambition. And of course, our marketing slogan, athletics, as we see it as our just do it, if you will, is our winning in paradise. But we absolutely believe that our potential does match our ambition. We do think that we're that young stock. We're not the mature Coca-Cola brand that is where they are. And many institutions are that are great blue blood stocks. You mentioned some of them, Alabama's and Ohio State. Those are great places. And we're obviously not that, but we're also nowhere near our peak or our maturity. So we do continue to have those same ambitions. And that's what drives us. Our facilities are competitive with some of those schools. I think most people would be shocked to see the facilities we've built here and helped us get to where we are. And we're in our youth, we're in our infancy still. And I absolutely believe that.
Making this move, that means more television opportunity, right?
Absolutely. Exponentially more. So we'll be on national television on a very regular basis. You know, I would argue the Americans athletic, their multimedia package is competitive with almost all of the Power Five. You know, I would take the SEC and in particular out of that scenario. But I think there's two or three of the Power Five leagues that the American television package is actually better than from an exposure standpoint, not from a financial standpoint, but from an exposure standpoint. You know, there's on a regular basis primetime games on ABC and the main ESPN that are American games and are not Power Five games. And that has not been the case historically, but I think Mike Oresko, as a former television executive, has done a great job building their package around exposure.
So more television time for the FAU football team and other teams. And of course, the other, when you're part of a conference, you get a bigger share of the pie when you're part of a bigger conference, because the conference gives money, that's TV money, to its schools, to its members. And I, from what I read, this could be $5, $6, $7 million more a year for FAU, right?
You know what? It may not be quite that much in the end, and we're still working through some of the details, but it'll be a whole lot more than what we earn now. So it'll be very significant what the revenue does for us. And on top of just the television revenue, when we have better brands and bigger brands coming into our stadium, it'll be better ticket sales. And it'll be, you know, better corporate sponsorship sales as we fill our stadium. So there's many revenue line items that improve when you're able to improve your conference positioning.
And I know that you're going to make that move again soon to the American Athletic Conference. But one of the other things, too, over the years, when you see the small programs build themselves up, part of it is, of course, every now and then they play those big games. You don't shy away from that. You've had those big games, like with the University of Florida and other big schools. Do you plan on still having those games?
Absolutely. You know, we see it as a big opportunity, and we'd love to play more. We've gotten one SEC school to play us in a 2-for-1, but that's, you know, 9 years out. So there's many of these games are scheduled so far out that it's hard to get, you know, big names in your stadium if they're not already on the schedule. But we're going to continue to try to get more teams into our stadium. But if we can't do that, we'll play them on the road. And we see them, our student athletes see them as big opportunities. And that's something that we're fully behind.
When does the school make the official move to the American Athletic?
We expect it to be 2023, but there are still some final details to be ironed out.
Mr. White, I really appreciate the time. Continued success for the university. And you know what? I mean, the late Coach Schnellenberger, unfortunately passed away before he gets to see it. But hopefully someday we'll see that promise come through.
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe it will. Thank you so much for having me on.
And again, that was Brian White, Director of Athletics at FAU. Just to mention, by the way, unfortunately, FAU lost its final game of the season this past weekend against Middle Tennessee. Had a losing record. Maybe they can turn things around. By the way, read more about the move on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, shoe fly, don't bother me. We asked local experts what flies are even good for. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, South Florida is prime real estate for flies, unfortunately for us. For many flies, the Everglades is just home, and the humid climate attracts them. Have you ever wondered, though, what exactly happens when one of those flies lands on your food? And what are flies even good for? Well, to answer those questions, we spoke with Ravindra Pallavali Netimi. He's a postdoctoral research associate at Florida International University. And Jamie Theobald, he's an associate professor of biological sciences at FIU. And their research focuses on these pesky insects. Jamie, all right, let's say a fly lands on my hamburger. Is it taking a bite out of my food? What is it doing?
Yeah, so most flies don't have sort of the apparatus to just take a bite. And this is, you know, one of the points of the article is that they have, depending on the fly, more spongy mouths, more like straws or sponges to pull up liquids. So liquids they can drink usually without trouble. But if it's a solid food, they need to start digesting it before they bring it into their body. And so often they'll put a little bit of a spit on it in order to bring, to start the digestion outside of their body and then slurp in what they get from that.
So they're spitting on my food before they can even eat it.
To digest it, yeah. So we do something similar with our saliva. It has some you know, weak digestive enzymes in it, amylase. So when you chew bread, for instance, it gets sweeter over time. That's a little bit of digestion happening right in your mouth.
Oh, Ravi, I mean, does that mean that they could be transferring any kind of germs or bacteria to my food? Should I be worried?
In the process, if the fly actually has some microbes in it, which can cause diseases, which can potentially cause diseases like cholera and typhoid, and if they regurgitate on the food and you ingest it, you might end up getting the disease. But then again, the chances do vary. It depends whether the fly is has the microbes, the harmful microbes on you, or whether the fly actually stays on your food long enough to transmit those onto your food.
I see. So how many seconds do I have after a fly lands on my food? What is it, the 5-second rule or what?
I don't think, if I may answer, I don't think there's a definitive answer as to how long does it take for them to, as far as we know, that there is no definitive answer for how long the flies need to be on the food to transmit the diseases. But it's always a good idea to assume that you don't want to eat that part of the food where the fly has landed.
Hmm.
I think your instincts are probably pretty good in this situation. If one fly lands on your food for 1 second and you shoo it away, you can probably still eat it. If you find food that's been out for half an hour and it's covered in flies, I wouldn't eat it.
That already sounds so not appealing. So I think that's fair to say. I got to ask both of you, Ravi, I'll start with you. Why'd you get into studying flies and insects? I mean, what's where did the interest come from?
A lot of things. I can mention a few things that are fascinating about them. At least to me, what's fascinating is their compound eyes. Right, so we have simple eyes. Their eye structure is slightly different. They have multiple lenses, around 800 of them, and so their vision is slightly less powerful than ours. But at the same time, they can do a lot of behaviors, like for example, finding a food source, flying long distances and navigating to a particular place. And that is what is fascinating to me. And at the same time, their brains are simpler compared to our brains just by the relative size of it. That means that we can actually understand what's happening when they're when they're performing a particular behavior. And that makes it an interesting study organism.
Mm. Jamie, what's the interest for you?
Well, I started out in biology just interested in sort of glamour animals, and reluctantly took an entomology course that I needed near the end of my undergraduate degree. And they told me right off the bat, there are two kinds of people that study insects, people who hate them and people who love them. The people who hate them want to learn how to exterminate them, and the people who love them are just drawn into them.
And which one are you?
I was certainly in the latter group.
Okay.
The insects and invertebrates, they're so diverse and so colorful, and they're just so much fun to work with. And people don't even know until they start studying them how enjoyable they are.
You know, I mean, one thing I do understand, you know, just, you know, as a person who's, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a researcher of any way, but just having read, and I think, I don't know, maybe it's just something inherent in humans. We understand that all things living have some kind of relationship to the environment around them. And I wondered, Jamie, but what purpose do flies and these insects have in our environment, in life?
Yeah, so before bees and wasps started pollinating, the flies were one of the larger groups of pollinators, and they still are today. So they're really important ecologically. They're very important for decomposition. My compost in my backyard is dominated by fly larvae, turning, you know, all the food that I didn't eat or couldn't eat into soil, you know, that the plants can grow from. And flies today, what else, Ravi? They have medical uses, of course.
Yeah. So flies such as blowflies, the maggots of these blowflies are used in treating infected wounds and ulcers. So scientists have been studying how studying the antimicrobial properties of the enzymes that these maggots release, so you can design therapeutics around wound healing, for example.
And then they're used in research extensively. It's an enormous component of modern biological research, particularly with the fruit fly. And so they're just tremendously important as a group.
I'm speaking with Ravindra Pallavali Natimi. He's a postdoctoral research associate at Florida International University. Also, Jamie Theobald. He's an associate professor of biological sciences at FIU. And we're talking about flies and what happens when they land on our food. They answered that question for a series called Curious Kids from the news site The Conversation. And you can find more on this topic on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so I know that you both love the, you know, what you're studying, but you know there are a lot of us who find them to be pesky and just bothersome. And so I'd imagine that people who research them, even if you love them, you must know how to get rid of them. So what would you tell the rest of us,
Ravi?
Well, there are a few ways. So especially if you have fruit flies or vinegar flies in your kitchen. So these are usually tiny flies that fly around your bananas, ripe bananas. So one way to get rid of them is to take a bottle and fill it with some vinegar and put a funnel inside. So the flies actually get attracted by this vinegar. They get inside through the funnel, but they cannot, they often can't find the entrance to the tiny funnel end, right? So that's one way to trap them. You can also use carnivorous plants that are known to eat certain flies. That's another way. And definitely if you do have a lot of flies in your house, house flies, for example, try to cover your food. Try not to put food items outside. So you're probably going to be fine. And what else?
Anything that encourages spiders or bats in your area and community probably will reduce the number of flies and mosquitoes around you. We do love researching them, but we're as annoyed by them in other settings as anyone else. But yeah, encouraging just a healthy ecology where they get eaten, they can perform their ecological services, and other animals can then then use them as food. So anything that just keeps them in a good balance, and spiders and bats are major parts of the whole chain.
And again, that was Jamie Theobald. He's an associate professor of biological sciences at FIU, and Ravindra Pallavini Nadimi. He is a postdoctoral research associate at FIU. And thank you both of them so much for the conversation. That's our program for this Monday, November 29th, coming up tomorrow on the show. You know, people might have thought Florida's recent gambling compact was a sure bet for the rise of sports betting. Not too fast, though. We're going to get the latest on a federal judge pumping the brakes on the state's deal. Plus, e-scooters are back in front of the Miami City Commission today. We're going to reach out to Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches tomorrow to get a full recap. What are the city's new safety concerns about those scooters? All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.